Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. As you know, we regularly feature veteran entrepreneurs who've built a successful career following their time in service. Some, like Bottle Breacher, started in their garage with an idea, and then they took it on the Shark Tank television show, and now they're a multi-million dollar business. Hank Robinson of Hanro Studios used the GI Bill to take a welding class when he couldn't find employment. He is now a master engraver to movie stars and rock and roll legends. Today's guest is a veteran of both military and law enforcement service, and while his path towards entrepreneurship was perhaps a bit less exotic, it has been just as successful. During his time in service, he identified a gap in the very practical needs of his comrades. He began filling that gap, and the rest, well, you'll just have to stay tuned to hear the rest of that story. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Philip Rue.
How you doing?
I'm just terrific, sir. How are you today?
Hey, really good. I actually got up early and showered and shaved, and then I realized, hey, this is radio. I don't have to shave.
Welcome to my life, Phil.
Oh, yeah. That's great. I like this whole idea of radio.
Yeah. It's you know, we still have to, you know, clean, sponge down everything like you do. But Phil, a little bit about you, your background, because this will apply later on in life. I tell you, one thing that if I could be king for a day, Phil, I would require every American young person to do two things. One is to spend a year overseas, anywhere, just to get a sense of how good we have it in the U.S. Number two would be to have them work on a farm for about 3 months to develop some work ethic and a sense of just how things are connected. You had that start.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to, I guess you could say I was lucky enough. At a young age, you don't realize, you know, what you have until you don't have it. But, yeah, I grew up on a farm in northern Wisconsin. And, I grew up in, part of the country where, you know, it's dairy farms and, you know, growing corn and you know, all the essentials. And you, as a kid, you kind of dread that day where they say, yeah, this is the last day of school, you know, because you know what's coming. You're going right to the farms. You're going to start plowing, and you're going to get on the tractors, and you're going to start getting ready, you know, to plant crops and everything else, you know. But yeah, it's I totally agree with you. The work ethic required, you know, growing up on the farms. I think it truly is it's a vanishing art. I mean, it really is. I think we're losing those generations that grew up on a farm and, you know, pass the information on to the next kid. And, I hate to see that disappearing, but it was great growing up, you know, on a farm when I was a kid.
Well, do you think, looking back, Phil, do you think that those lessons learned have applied to your entrepreneurial spirit even today?
Oh, absolutely. I think anybody that, you know, had the opportunity to grow up in that type of environment where it's, you know, you get up, it's dark out, you're feeding animals, you're making sure all the animals are going to stay alive for the day. And then you get to, you know, take a bath or shower or whatever. We had a bath, we didn't have a shower. And then, you know, you walk, half a mile uphill in the storms, you know, to get to the school bus, you know.
Yeah. Hey, my dad tells a story of my grandfather having to get out in front of the big old plow horse to break the snowdrifts because even the horse couldn't get through. So I believe you on that one. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, Phil, you served both in the Army as well as a law enforcement officer. What was the path that took you from the farm to the Army?
Well, my grandfather served in World War II. My uncle served in Vietnam, and I was just always fascinated with it. Listening to some of the stories and just the idea of serving the country. And you know, obviously where I grew up, I mean, there's American flags everywhere. Every farm you go past, barns are painted with flags on them. I mean, it's just the way it is. You know, I mean, everyone's very, very patriotic in those areas of the country. And so I was always intrigued. And, growing up on a farm, we had about 60 or 70 acres of woods and fields and all my friends. And, we'd go out in the woods and we'd build forts. And, you know, my mom and dad would say, yeah, kids, get out of the house, go spend a couple of days in the woods. And we would, you know, we'd just go disappear in the woods for a couple of days. And it just always intrigued me. It was just, you know, always in the back of my mind. And when I turned 18, I moved to Phoenix, where my dad was at. And I had some, you know, in high school, I worked in a sporting goods store. And I actually moved to Phoenix to, of all things, bicycle race. I was a road racer. And I came out here to see if I had, you know, what it takes to be a professional cyclist, believe it or not. And quickly learned that I made a better mechanic than I did a racer. Mm-hmm. So didn't have the genetics for that. So I was working in a sporting goods store in Phoenix. And one day I was just driving home back to my dad's house. And I saw an Army recruitment sign on the side of the road. And the next thing I knew, I was parked in front of the building and getting out, and there was, you know, four or five guys all standing there smoking and, you know, chit-chatting back and forth. And I walked up, and I remember this to this day. I walked up to the four of these men. I said, "Sign me up." Well, that's an exciting thing to hear if you're a recruiter. You know?
Sure. Sure. Now, Phil, what's interesting, because this applies to your evolution into your business. I don't know how much you can talk about this, but I think it's important for the listeners to understand. During your time in the Army, you were loaned, I guess, maybe is a close enough word to other federal agencies doing some work.
Yeah, there's, I mean, those listeners out there probably have done something similar, probably know what I'm talking about if they're prior military. There's, you know, if you're a reserve, so I was reserves, and I had found out about this counter drug program that the military had, and I was like, well, how do I do that? Because that really intrigues me. And it just so happened where our headquarters was located at. There was a building nearby, and one day I was out there, you know, working, and there's all these people showing up and getting on helicopters and flying off. And I said, it looks like they're going on maneuvers. You know, who is that? And they said, well, it's the state counter drug. They run intercept missions down the U.S.-Mexican border. You know, they get loaned out to agencies. And my lieutenant at the time just gave me just a little bit of information about it. And so I said, I am going to do that. I want to do that. And kind of just started trying to find out where to go, who to talk to, and ultimately found this building that was kind of unmarked and banged on the door until they answered and opened the door and let me in. And I just said, what do I have to do?
So you're already showing a trend, Phil, of just walking up and saying, sign me up. First the recruiters, and now these guys.
I do my research. I mean, I do my research, and I've just always, you know, growing up as a kid, my parents always said, you know, there's really, you know, set your mind to it and, you know, you can do it. You know, I grew up in that era of, you know, you didn't get handed a trophy for showing up. I mean, you had to earn it, you know what I mean? So, I just, you know, if there was something that, you know, I thought that would better myself and something I could do that was, you know, good for the country and just intrigued me, I just figured, you know, it wouldn't hurt to at least go talk to somebody, you know, and find out what it is they exactly do and see if I fit in. So that's what I did, and found out there was a testing process and went through the testing process and got switched over to basically active duty orders. And that started my career in, you know, counter drug with the military.
Phil, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about the next step in your career, which seems natural, given what you've told us, and that was into civilian law enforcement. Before we do that, though, how long did you spend doing these drug interdiction missions?
I think I was on the program for 5 years, if I had to go back and look. I think right around 5 years.
Okay, so it's a pretty significant amount of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And things were happening really fast back then, too. So,
okay. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Phil Rue. He's with Arizona Shooters World. You can learn more. Visit azshootersworld.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about Phil's next step in his career, which seems a logical one. He became a member of the Glendale Police Department. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. For our veteran entrepreneur segment today, we're joined by Phil Rue. He is, Phil, with typical entrepreneurs, you don't really have a title. You're, head bottle washer, janitor, CEO, but officially, what does it say on your business card?
Oh, the radio, the sound kind of blocked that out a little bit. What was that about the business card?
What is your official title, Phil?
CEO of Shooters World, yes.
Okay, all right. And folks can find out more at azshootersworld.com. Phil, before the break, we were talking about your military career. You then made the transition to civilian law enforcement with the Glendale, Arizona Police Department. Explain that jump for us and how that... Because all these things, it's interesting to me, Phil, looking, they all come together and sort of add up in the puzzle that became Phil Rue, the CEO of AZ Shooters World.
Well, it's kind of an interesting little twist. I mean, I was doing counter-drug missions, so we're doing intercept missions, and there was two of us that were pulled from various programs within the counter-drug work that we were doing and asked to go to DEA. And so it was while I was at DEA, right around the time methamphetamine was just hitting the streets. So this is early 90s. I still remember being interviewed by the special agent in charge of DEA at the time here in Phoenix. Myself and a friend of mine walked in, and she said, what do you know about methamphetamine? And we both looked at each other and said, we've never heard of it. So it kind of goes, gives you an idea as to mm-hmm. how far back we go on that. But we were there for about 2 years, and it was right around the time period former President Clinton came into office. He was cutting budgets, and at the time, I was married and had a young son and another baby on the way, and it's like, I want to keep going with this, and I want to get into law enforcement. But I was really, really enjoying what I was doing on the federal side. Really learning a lot. It's just amazing the power the federal side has and what we were achieving at the time. And so I didn't want to give that up. So I actually tested with Glendale Police Department and got them to sponsor me as a reserve officer so I could actually go to the academy while I was still at DEA and pick up my post-certification. And then that would hopefully eventually I'd have the option of going full-time if I wanted to. But I was learning a lot while I was working the federal side, and I was really fortunate to basically be assigned to one of the first DEA agents. He was kind of known as the dinosaur. He was just a phenomenal mentor, and I knew I was learning a lot. I knew that I was being exposed to just a wealth of knowledge and. I really appreciated the time that I was able to spend with him. And so knowing that our funding was kind of getting cut, I was kind of preparing to make the jump to the civilian world, full-time law enforcement with Glendale. And an opportunity came up through a contact I had made through DEA and made the decision to switch over and go full-time law enforcement. And that was in 2000 and I think that was like 2000. No, I'm sorry. It was 98. So that was 1998. Yeah.
Now, Phil, we've all seen the movies and the hard time they give to rookies, but they learned pretty quick that you brought a certain level of expertise. You talked about the timing of the emergence of meth as a drug of choice, and lo and behold, here's a rookie who knows everything you need to know about meth, on the good side.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. So I had a field training officer, Johnny Mack. He had, I think, the lowest serial number at Glendale PD at the time, former Vietnam vet, just a rusty, crusty guy. He made it very clear. He said, "I don't like reserve officers, and you need to go through a hard academy, and all these different things." And so, but what I also realized very quickly was this man had an unbelievable amount of knowledge, on the street. So again, I had kind of lucked out. I had this DEA agent that I was able to work under for quite some time, and then when I transitioned to Glendale, my field training officer was, a seasoned Vietnam vet with almost a couple decades of street smarts under him, and I just I felt very, very lucky to be assigned to him. And so, getting to, he didn't really know my background. He just thought I was, some, Army reservist that, was bored and wanted to carry a gun, right? So, so we started going out on patrols and going through our field training programs, and we started getting calls at night from different narcotics units, primarily Glendale's, and they would say, "Hey, we need your rookie at this address. We need him to take a look at something." And so, my field training officer would look at me and say, "Well, why do they want you there?" I says, "Well, I've got a little bit of background, I've got some knowledge, So, we would go to these meth lab sites where, these undercover units would discover this huge meth lab, and they really didn't understand what they had sometimes. And so, having spent all that time at DEA, I could show up and I could look at the chemicals, and I still had the cell phone numbers for the DEA chemist on my cell phone. I would call them up anytime. I'd say, "Hey, here's what we're dealing with." And they could give us exactly, what they were attempting. And so that helped with probable cause. Cause in the early 90s, it was, they're either making drugs or they're making explosives. And sometimes, it's both. So, you really need to.
And you didn't have those little handy, "it turns purple if it is" kits at the time, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Or whatever the color is.
Oh, yeah. It's really interesting. Back then, it was just, what is this? I mean, you had rolling meth labs. And if you ever watch the series, Breaking Bad, that is probably as accurate as you could possibly ever get. Whoever was the fact checker on that did a great job. But, yes, we started going to these drug labs, and then I would be asked to go check a particular address, and somebody, was smelling a weird odor, and sure enough, I'd get into an area, and I'm like, "Yes, there's a meth lab in the area, I guarantee you." And so we'd set up some kind of a grid and, eventually locate it. So,
Phil, let's talk about, because is this about the time when you started to sort of get the taste for filling that gap in need? As I understand it, you both on the military side and the law enforcement side, you are looking around and you're seeing that some of your comrades and coworkers, they just, let's be honest, you say they had subpar equipment.
It was awful. I mean, early 90s, some of the stuff that we were doing, counter-drug intercept missions with, and we're wearing Vietnam-era, jungle boots, and it's like, wait a second. I've worked in some really high-end sporting goods stores and hiking and, expedition stores. I mean, there's some good boots out there that won't kill your feet. There's clothing that, will actually wick, the moisture away from your skin because, back then that stuff didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It was just coming around. Under Armour did not exist. People don't realize, how new some of these these companies are. I was a hunter too, and so I was used to extreme weathers and hypothermia, protection, that kind of thing. And I'm like, all this equipment is just horrible. I can't believe we're using this. And so, having some business background, I went and got a business license and talked to some manufacturers and said, "Listen, I want to represent your product in the Southwest. I'm technically active duty military, but I've got a lot of connections." So, growing up, I watched my dad, my grandpas, my uncles. Anytime you went and did something with somebody, everything was done on a handshake, no written contracts. It was all networking, and I kind of carried that through my military days. Anytime I met somebody, "Do you have a business card? Do you have a business card? Do you have a business card?" And, never threw them away. So once I started putting together, some really good equipment, word spread quickly. I mean, like lightning. And so while I would go on missions, my wife at the time would help to get orders in, process them, and get them out to agencies, and it just started growing like crazy. And believe it or not, one of the craziest things that ever happened, we put together this little flyer of some of the brands that we had, and things were starting to you know, kind of grow. And it was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. My phone rang at the house. I got out of bed. I go to answer it. And it was actually a nuclear subgroup calling me via satellite uplink. So I recognized the delay in the guy's voice. And I'm like, are you talking to me via satellite? And he says, yes. He told me who they were. Can't repeat it. And he says, listen, we need some emergency gear. You know, can you supply us? And I said, yeah, I can supply you. So kind of crazy.
Did you ask them where they found you?
I did. And it came back to them getting some information from a particular narcotics guy who was associated with a three-letter agency. And this guy just happened to be with this group at the time. Kind of convoluted. I can't repeat some of it, but ultimately this guy was getting a ride somewhere and realized that this equipment was compromised. And so he said, hey, I've got this little flyer from this guy in Phoenix.
Wow. You know?
It was insane.
Phil,
it was
like we need to take a break again here, but what a great story, because I'm guessing you don't see – you know, Los Angeles class attack submarines sailing up the Salt River very often there into the Tempe Town Lake.
Not that
we're aware.
I'd like to. That'd be fun. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Phil Rue. He's the CEO of Arizona Shooters World. Next, we're going to talk about his transition from those flyer days to actual hard stores, two of them in the Valley right now. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. For our veteran entrepreneur feature today, we're talking with Phil Rue. Phil is the CEO of AZ Shooters World. You can find out more at azshootersworld.com. That makes sense, Phil. Phil, every entrepreneur faces a point where they are either offered the opportunity or they have to make the conscious decision to step it up to the next level. As I understand it, you are... have been growing your little tactical side business. You set up shop in Arizona Shooters World, and then one day the owner came to you with an offer you couldn't refuse.
Well, I actually refused it a few times. It was numbers that just absolutely boggled my mind. You know, I mean, I was I was with Glendale PD at the time, and the business was still growing. My wife at the time was handling the orders out of the house. I was making contacts and flying all over the place on my days off. And so we were renting about 1,000 square feet from the owner of Shooters World at the time. And I was offered the chance to, and I said, well, how much is it? And he said, well, it's $1,400 a month for this little spot within our building. And I was like, that's a lot of money. I only pay $625 a month for my house. That's huge. So we started in as soon as we opened the showroom, things just went nuts. We were the only store of our kind at the time. Now there's tactical shops all over the place. But at the time, we were it. We were the only ones that were offering top-tier equipment. Word spread quickly. And the owner of Shooters World at the time would stop in. He was kind of an absentee owner. He was completely hands-off. And he would see, I had all kinds of customers in my store, and Shooters World was pretty slow at the time. He had no inventory, nothing that, he would really want to buy. And so, long story short, after a while, I'm like, well, okay, so how much is it? Like, what would it take to buy it, I guess, you know? And he presented me with an offer, and it was still a lot of money. He was going to carry the loan, and I'm trying to figure this out business-wise, if it made sense. And he's like, I'll carry the loan for 2 years, and all you got to do is you have to come up with $100,000 down, and it's yours. And that was just a phenomenal amount of money, And I mean, now my payroll is almost that, every 2 weeks. It was like, But so I kind of brushed him off, and I just happened to be at a get together with some friends of mine, a buddy of mine that I was in the police academy with, and a friend of their families that we were familiar with. I was telling the story about buying it, and he stepped forward and he said, I've watched you grow Arizona Tactical. I know your work ethic. I know that location. I know the building. I think it's a great investment for you. I'll loan you the $100,000. And we quickly came up with a handshake deal. And about 5 days later, I was sitting down with the owner of Shooter's World, and we were buying it.
So, beginning, as I understand, in June 2002, you embarked on a mission to create the best civilian shooting and training facility ever. One of the things that I'm wondering that might have played, when people go to your website, they see, I mean, you have product. There's no question about that. You've got, and in times of COVID, it's interesting, you still have lots of weapons and lots of ammunition, which is not easy to find. But what really stands out to me is what maybe is the more important part of your business, and that is training people and making sure it's the right fit for them. Was that because throughout your career you came across a lot of victims and you just felt compelled to help folks?
There's a lot of different things I was really trying to bite off. One, on the equipment side, you know, it was saving lives. I got into designing body armor, and that still to this date is a huge passion of mine. I have patents in the body armor industry. I just submitted for another one. I want to design the best armor and offer the best protection, you know, we can give our first responders, you know, so that's a huge rewarding thing for me to do. On the other side of it, yes, as a police officer, I would continually come across victims, and you know, they just really didn't know what options they had. And you know, for law enforcement, military, first front, you know, we know there's always an academy or there's an instructor that teaches you, or there is a level of training that you are required, you know, and mandated to attend. For the civilian world, there really wasn't much, and I had been operating out of this range for a few years, and I saw a huge potential. I had a lot of friends in the Southwest. I knew I could bring them in and offer realistic training, not only putting rounds down range, but I really wanted to go after the mental aspect of it as well. Like, you know, what is it going to take for you mentally not to be a victim? And so we worked on it. We came up with realistic curriculum, and I was still a full-time cop at the time. And about the only thing that saved me from that time was a new product hit the market called Red Bull, you know. So
hey, again, they're not an advertiser. Myself. Mention them once.
That's it. Phil, so an energy drink came up, and that really helped me until I just finally had to make the decision to resign from Glendale and work the businesses full time. So,
Phil, part of the reason I wanted to talk to you now is just we're all living through very, and I use the air quotes, interesting times. And for your business in particular, it's got to be even more so. So I want to pick your brain and share with our listeners some of the unique aspects and what you're seeing out there. There was a National Shooting Sports Foundation survey that showed that gun retailers have seen a 95% increase in firearm sales, 139% increase in ammunition sales in the first 6 months of the year versus 2019. 40% of those customers were women, 50% increase in African-American purchasers. What are you seeing? I thought I heard you once say that really your demographics is truly a melting pot.
We thought we were a melting pot. We were kind of going after. We really went after the female market when I first bought Shooter's World, because they were the victims I was coming across. And it's like, let's get them in for free, you know, one day a week, and let's give them free gun rentals, and let's do all these things to just make it less, you know, intimidating. You have to get rid of that intimidation factor. And so we thought we had this melting pot of, you know, I know for a fact I have more women shooters that come to our facilities than any other range in the country. And so we were successful there. But the one thing that I was missing was there's all these, you know, all these other groups. It's, you know, the different nationalities and ethnic, you know, backgrounds and, you know, all these different groups that we were kind of missing out on. And, you know, as soon as the shutdowns started to, you know, go into effect, you know, the beginning of February, It was absolutely mind-boggling to me, you know, the effect that had, you know, on the public, and then what we started seeing, you know, as far as, you know, the customers coming through the door. And so some of the numbers you just gave me, I would say, yeah, those are probably, you know, pretty close.
I tell you, Phil, what astounded me and frightened me at the same time, because like you, I grew up, I don't want to say work on the land, but we were country folk, and a weapon was just like any other tool. It was like a chainsaw or a tractor or a good sharp axe. You know, it's just, you respect it, you learn how to use it, and you stay safe. I think I read somewhere that something like 40% of the gun buyers now are first-time buyers.
Well, if you got to break that, you can break that down even further. So when COVID hit, those first couple weeks were existing gun owners that knew enough to come in and grab a little extra ammo, maybe on a gun. But the existing gun owners, that market quickly switched over to, and it was almost like I remember the Saturday. I mean, our staff is working basically mandatory overtime, no days off. I mean, everyone's just working their tails off. And it was a Saturday, and we're all standing behind the counter just getting ready for the day. There's probably 70-some people in line. And when they walked in, almost every person was a new gun buyer. Almost every single one.
A first-time gun buyer.
First-time, yeah. First-time gun buyer. And, you know, I mean, we had roped areas, you know, like you're at the circus. I mean, we had, you know, you got to, like, go in lines. And, I mean, we were managing the flow as much as we can and trying to maintain, you know, the restrictions, the health, you know, restrictions. But literally 70 people in line, all first-time gun buyers coming in to buy a firearm. And within that group, it was just amazing. Every customer that I spoke with, you know, what brought them in, who they were, what's your background. I mean, in one day, I had about 8 people, men and women, come in scrubs between shifts to buy a gun.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's just absolutely, absolutely amazing. So, I agree with some of the numbers that you gave me about NSSF's numbers. But here's what was also interesting to me was, probably 2 dozen times I would have a customer come up to me and I'd listen, this is my, you know, I've never owned a firearm. And so, you know, I've been doing my research and, you know, here's what I think I want, but, you know, please tell me what you think. And when I'm done here, where do I go to sign up for classes?
Yeah.
So it is a completely different group.
Phil, hold that thought, because I want to follow up on that again when we come back and get to use one of my favorite movie quotes of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia, we're talking with Phil Rue, the CEO of AZ Shooters World. You can find out more at azshooterworld.com. Interesting chat about doing business in the gun industry in the time of COVID. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking with Phil Rue. Phil is the CEO of Arizona Shooters World. You can find out more at azshootersworld.com. Phil, I'm not going to bother to try and imitate Clint Eastwood, but there's that famous line about the .44 Magnum being the most powerful handgun in the world. Do you feel lucky, punk? I shoot much better with my Springfield .45 than my Sig 9mm. It has nothing to do with the caliber, but more so the comfort I have for some reason with that particular weapon. When you see folks coming in, first-time home buyers, first-time weapon buyers, and they want a .44 Magnum, is it part of your job to talk them out of that caliber, talk them into the right caliber, or maybe convince them that they really shouldn't be owning a firearm?
Well, it's when we get the new shooters that come in, and we're, you know, this COVID time is you know, obviously the the most we've ever seen, you know, in a condensed, you know, time period. They come in, say they're, you know, they let us know that they're a first time gun buyer, never shot a gun, or maybe they shot a gun with Uncle Bob, you know, 2 decades ago. And then they ask their, you know, friend down the street who's a retired cop, and the cop said, oh, you got to have a 40 cal, or, oh, no, the bigger the bullet, the better. Yes, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that we have to kind of counter or offer, you know, our opinion on. And then what's nice about our facility is when you've got a customer that comes in and says, listen, okay, you're really focusing in on a 40 caliber handgun. Okay, I tell you what, let's take you to the range and let's you know, have you shoot a 40 cal as opposed to a 9mm or a 380. And so once you get them on a range and they're actually shooting them, that really helps to it really helps that new customer with their first gun purchase, because they quickly learn, well, you know, why did my neighbor you know, recommend this caliber? You know, this is crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. So what our crew, our team really, really does a good job of is really figuring out, you know, and talking to the customer and finding out what are you going to be using this for, and not only, you know, find the right caliber, but, you know, in a 9mm handgun, you can go from, you know, super compact, you know, fit the palm of your hand, all the way to some, you know, 6, 7, 8 inch, you know, barrel, you know, with a scope on it on your hip. You know, are you going to take this with you every day? And interestingly enough, about 75% to 80% of those new customers, first-time buyers coming in, said, no, you know, I'm going to buy this for home protection. And, you know, we would tell them, you know, almost everyone comes back saying, you know, we realized we don't spend a lot of time at home. We're always out and about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we bought this big gun, you know, and we want something smaller that makes more sense to carry with us. So our team is really good at, you know, educating people on, you know, here's the actual, you know, real percentage. You're probably going to want to take this with you. And if you do take it with you, you need to be able to carry it on your person in some way, shape, or form.
Phil, you might get a kick out of this. This is Ben's embarrassing story of the show. My wife, I wanted to be sure she knew how to handle a firearm, and she jumps at any loud noise. So we're at the range and she's just, you know, everybody in the lanes are shooting and she's hopping up and down. It's kind of crazy. So I give her the 45 after properly instructing her how to use it, move the target out to 21 feet. Her first two rounds were center X. And I took the weapon back and I said, that's it. I'm not bringing you here anymore. We're done. But I mean, that, I guess that, you know, the question really is, for some people, I don't want to say it's a knee jerk reaction, but really, honestly, some people might want to explore other alternatives. And I assume you can help them with that as well, whether it be mace or a baton or.
Yeah, we've got one of the things we've always focused on is having options. You know, and with, you know, law enforcement days, I was, you know, there was, you know, a handful of times I came close to getting involved in a shooting, but we were able to de-escalate because of other tools that we had access to. And we try to instill that in our customers. It's like, what do you think your chances are of actually using your firearm as opposed to, you know, you may have to use pepper spray. You may have to use some kind of impact device. Or one of the best classes we've ever offered was a improvised weapons class. You know, it's like, what do you have around you that you can use to protect yourself? That's the highest percentage of crimes are going to be committed against you. But, you know, the firearm is the, you know, ultimate insurance policy, right? So we offer, you know, phenomenal, really, really good pepper sprays, impact devices, simple keychain self-defense tools. You know, if someone comes up and tries to attack you, we've got a pretty good wide range of products that give you additional options.
Phil, we're running out of time. We've got about 2 minutes left. I'm curious, you know, for some of our other entrepreneurs out there or aspiring entrepreneurs, you've been doing this for, gosh, 18 years, maybe longer. What would be your sort of 1, 2, 3 bullet point advice for them?
If you're looking at getting into business now, things have changed quite a bit. You know, you're going to want to, you know, is it a business that you're going to spend time developing that you can do even if a governor or a president says you're no longer essential, you need to stay home? That is going to be in the back of every new entrepreneur's mind. And it should be. Once you figure out what you want to do, networking is huge in business. We are finding that out right now. The reason we have more inventory on our shelves right now than any other indoor shooting range, gun shop, you name it, is because of the relationships that we have with suppliers, dealers, manufacturers, period. Without those, we would be in the same boat that our competition is in. We shop our competition constantly, and they've got nothing, and we've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds, you know, of different firearms on the wall. I mean, our inventory is, you know, really good, and we've got ammunition, but relationships are huge. And if that is something that you're good at and strong at, you will be able to create a successful business.
What's next for Phil Rue in Arizona Shooters World? I mean, this can't last forever, right?
Oh, we're gonna keep improving the range industry. My wife Lisa is phenomenal. I mean, her business sense is, you know, way better than mine. I with her helping develop new curriculum and different routes. When she came into the business, she really helped me change our image and really go after that female demographic. How do we get a woman from the street to walk in that door and feel comfortable in our facility? She's also helping with the buying now and developing those relationships. We've got two phenomenal buyers that have just been doing a killer job, and our goal right now is to keep the shelf stocked and work on store three. So,
Phil, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Again, folks, you can visit azshootersworld.com. This podcast and others, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Find us on Stitcher, Deezer, Apple. We're everywhere. Look us up and please share. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.